in September, and
the topic is, what did we say it was?
A theological coloring book. And tonight we're talking about God births a people. God births a people. You can tell from that introduction, I haven't done this before. This is the first time, so I'm as curious as you are as what's going to happen. Try to figure this out. And I don't know how to get into the coloring book aspect of it, so I'm going to try, and you know, if we don't succeed, we'll try again. Are any of you willing to admit that you're old?
No.
Oh, good. All right. The thing that is curious to me is that that word old has so many different meanings. What are some of the things the word old means to you? Just, you know, say them. What up, Mama?
Yeah, age-wise old.
Pardon? Age-wise old. Yeah. But age-wise old. See how she sneaks that in?
Experience.
Very good. What else?
Experienced.
Experienced.
More physical problems.
Okay. Well, let me take it away. Now, I led you in the wrong direction. I asked you if you felt old, and that you answered. Now, back away from that and just take the word old in any context. Any context, but including age and everything else, but any context. What's that word mean to you? Okay, now.
Used.
Pardon?
Used.
Used. Oh, all right.
Out of touch.
Out of touch.
Passage of time.
Having a good time?
Passage of time.
Oh, passage of time. All right. You can tell how old is that affecting me. All right.
Valuable.
Valuable.
Antiques.
Antique, which may be valuable. Somebody else.
Time to rest.
Time to rest. I like that. How about stale? Mixed and
worn out.
Can mean rotten. Oh gee, this is old. I don't want that.
Mm-hmm. Wise.
And then the old man spoke to them.
Precious.
Pardon?
Precious.
At your prime.
See, it has a lot of hope connected with it too.
Oh, they know.
Experience
was mentioned here. Good. Glad to have it come in again. That's good. Anyone else? Well, let me now. That was all introduction to my introduction. We're stuck with an old story in the scriptures. We're stuck with an old story. Now, for some people, that means stale. And that means used, you know, past your prime or whatever else it may mean. That word has meant that we've talked about. But the word that old story we're stuck with is also valuable and contains experience and is an antique in a delightful sense of the term. I don't know. I'll guess. I guess that I may be out of sync with some critics of the church today who think the church is going in the wrong direction and all kinds of other stuff. I don't. But I think the church is having a terrible struggle to make the old possibly stale to somebody, story fresh again and alive and attractive and exciting. I don't know about you, but I go to church. I like to brag. And boy, sometimes I'm really bored. And you know the part that I tend to get most bored at? And what the church calls preaching the gospel. I think some of the most hackneyed and old time and redone and unthought through times comes when some of us, as preachers and as lay people, try to talk about the good news. It's usually, usually we're better at the law, you know? If I had to evaluate my, I've been here in the village about 6 or 7 days, I think I've had heard here better law preaching at, and I've done some of the preaching, at matins and other places than I've heard gospel. We tend to, come back at me on this, you know, if you do agree and you're hearing different things, because I'd like to hear different things. We tend to use old ways of saying the old things. And sometimes that's plenty good. I was at my wife's deathbed. And I didn't look for any new stuff then. You know, simple stuff did it all. But in between, my wife would have fallen asleep too, in church and elsewhere, if it had been just the old stuff. There had to be something not new in the sense of God hasn't done it all yet, but fresh in the sense of somebody being excited about what this is all about. And therefore, now boy, I'm really sticking my neck out. Therefore, and it's on tape, oh boy. Therefore, Dan Erlander has been writing books. Dan Erlander is one of, I'm couching this very carefully, one of the best loved teachers at Holden Village. I heard him first, he's been up here many times, lived here for 2 or 3 years. I heard him first sitting about where you're sitting there, and he was teaching from up there. And I said to myself, he's heard this, so I don't care if he hears this tape. I said, who let this clod in here? I wondered who had tied his shoes that morning. You know, and about 17 minutes later, I found out that that clod had me in the palm of his hand. Looked like a clod, tried to. Sounded like a clod. Like I said, I wondered who tied his shoes. But as John Schramm, the director of Holden Village, said one time, this is the fellow who can get under your radar and right into where you live. Dan's a great teacher. I think he's a great teacher. I wish he were teaching more. So he has written 3 books, and the one we're talking about is, this time, is Manna and Mercy. This came off the press week before last in Albuquerque. It was shipped up, I got it from Dan on Saturday, and they have some here in the store. He's written 2 others, Justified by Faith, which is about the use of nuclear power, and the one that has sold thousands, and I mean thousands, a couple thousand a month, is called Baptized We Live. And it looks like this, only it's thinner. And that's an introduction to the Christian faith from a Lutheran perspective. And pastors all over the country are using Baptized We Live. And this is the new book that just came out. Dan has been working on this at, well, it seems to me like 400 years, but I know it's probably 3 or 4 years. And he said simply when he started out, he said, I think I'll do a book on the story of God. You know, he didn't want to limit it too much. So that's what he did. And his first paragraph in the introduction of the book starts out that way. This is a booklet about God. More specifically, the God of the Bible, who is present and active in human history and in all creation. May I remind you of the audacity of this project? You know, I didn't think he had to remind us. You know, that he was going to take on the story of God. And the reason that Dan did it, I think, is to help freshen up our thinking about the old stuff. There's loads of old vintage. Hey, there's another one for old, huh? Vintage stuff in here. And the reason it's fresh, in my thinking, is that Daniel is one of these blessed people, and I don't know many, maybe you do, who thinks in pictures and has to translate into words. When you talk to Daniel, he's hearing pictures. And then he has to translate it into words. You know, the rest of us, you know, we work like mad getting words right, and then we have to sit around and stew about how could we put this into some kind of picture. At least that's the way I am. But Dan is the other way around. And therefore, if you haven't seen any of Daniel's stuff, just let me hold up a couple pages here. Because he did all the work in this book. He wrote it all. He printed it all out by hand and did all the artwork as well. He does all of that. That's his stuff. And it's intriguing. At least I think it is. Even the footnotes in the back, or the endnotes as he calls them, has all kinds of illustrations in them. You'd think he'd be done, you know, when you get and just put down the date of the book or something like that in the publisher. But he's got all kinds of pictures, even in what would be known as the footnotes. There are a couple of ways I was going to do this that I decided not to do it, and I'm glad. It has 78 pages and 16 chapters. I'm going to tackle 4 or 5 chapters a day. We have 4 sessions, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, for those of you who are going to be around and you're invited to come back. And I'll try to give you a bit of a synopsis of what this is about. And I'll be frank to say I'm going to encourage you to buy the book. It's over in the bookstore. It's more expensive than his other ones. Everything's up, I guess. I think the price they have over there is $8. I bought copies of it before I knew it was that price. I might not have bought as many if I'd have known that. But I'm going to encourage you to read it, take it along, and share it. And I think it can make some good Bible study material, or just class material, the rest. Dan is an artist and theologian. I don't think he would call himself a biblical scholar, but I think he is. And he's a guy who reads broadly and strangely enough, remembers what he reads. I meet a lot of people who read and, you know, you can't tell from one year to the next they've read anything. It doesn't seem to sink in. And it does with Dan. And up front, he tells some of the people who have influenced him pretty strongly in the preparation for this as well. Let me do one little more exercise to get you at what Dan thinks, what I'm interpreting Dan, I don't know. What I think Dan thinks is a critical, something critical missing in our thinking about God, okay? Don't answer this question quickly. Try to answer it for yourself. That's pretty bold to do in a group that just gets together for the first time, but let's try. What's the point of believing in God? What's the point? Anyone?
Strength. He provides strength.
Okay.
A purpose for living.
Let everybody say whatever they want to say. Yeah, okay.
A purpose for living.
Pardon?
He becomes a purpose for living.
God becomes a purpose for living. Okay, all right.
It enlarges my mind to the possibilities of another realm of existence.
Hmm.
If I'm created in his image, why go against him?
Okay.
He helps me create something out of the nothingness.
Hmm. He gives me something to believe in that's outside myself and my strength.
Courage to have an open heart.
Okay.
the balm of forgiveness.
Okay. Anybody else? Anything you say, you know, it doesn't have to be.
He provides a framework on which I hang my life.
I like your way of saying it. That's nice. Somebody else?
Gets me through some days.
Pardon?
Gets me through some days.
Gets me through some days.
Mm-hmm. Gets you through all days. Some days.
And the older you get. Yeah, I think the some days had quotes around it, meaning tough days. But, I don't know. Roman had the... go ahead, please.
He gives me a purpose for living.
Okay. Ties in with what he has said. Roman is close to what... at least I, as I understand Roman's comment, is what Dan does. Is that in addition to all the personal help that God gives us in Jesus Christ, and all of the good things we can see in many, many ways, and the opportunities... it is the possibility of a whole new realm, a whole new way of being in the whole of existence that Dan thinks the scriptures bring to us. Now that's in some ways not anything new or different than other stuff, but it provides a context in which lots of the stuff we were talking about here, and that I would have mentioned here too, fits. And that's why he wants to go all the way back to the beginning in his theological coloring book and bring it up to where we are at this moment as well. By the way, the coloring book is in the first, let's see, page, Roman 3, introduction. He suggests you buy colored pencils and color the book. And, you know, you may have noticed I started on the front page and I've colored in some of the stuff. And he suggests that all the people in the book, which are all just white, that you buy extra brown pencils because most of those people would have been non-white. And you can fill them that way and you'll be reminded that the story is about all kinds of people. So it is a coloring book. He didn't set out to do a coloring book, but it turns out that way. And he says, well, all right, then make it a coloring book. And so you're welcome to do that as well. So he starts with, in chapter 1, with the birthing of a nation, talks about, of a people, and talks about how God sees this speck in the universe. The speck moving around an absolutely unimportant star. And on this speck, it decides to try an experiment and makes it possible to create life on the speck. And the life that comes out of it is all kinds, plant and animal and stuff. And then he inserts into it the possibility of something on that speck becoming of the earth or soil. Humus. A human. And that on that human was to live out on that speck what God's dream was for that whole universe. And Dan creates out of biblical stuff, and you can read his references. He's got loads of biblical references in there. That this was pretty much God's idea. I think I'll try and see if it works. And so God goes through making all the things that are on this earth, and then as Dan says at the bottom of the first page, and God said it was tov, very, very tov. T-O-V is the Hebrew word for good. And when you hear, see the tov, it even looks better than the word good. And so the experiment on the speck is going along. But that someone on the speck figures out
that it's possible to be a big deal. And the way you get to be a big deal is to push other people around and control other people or grab stuff for yourself, because you get more stuff, then you're a bigger deal than somebody else who hasn't got that much stuff. And you start keeping score. I think I'm going to use a story that Dan often uses in Vespers tomorrow night about keeping score. And if you can keep score, then, because if you don't keep score, how are you going to know who's a big deal? And so big deal leads to more stuff, and finally you find out two big deals try to get at each other, and they start whacking away each other and killing each other. And the whole thing goes to pot. And as Jan says, God groans because his experiment has fallen apart. And then God, and this, I think we often miss this, God goes into consultation with himself or herself and says, well, what should I do about this? He considers blowing it away. Snap of the finger, forget it. Bad experiment. But then he says, how can a mother destroy her child, her delight, her joy? So God says, well, maybe I should sort of open the heavens and just scare the daylights out of these people. His picture is God pulling back and letting you get a good look at God the way God is or whatever. Blah! Terrorize them. And they'll shape up or I'll come and get you. But after, as Dan says, the Creator in passionate love finally decides on another way. God decides to mend the universe. To mend the universe. And that's the story that Dan wants to tell in his book, How God Goes About Mending the Universe. And it starts out in his chapter 2, in the birth of a people, that God was vexed. I always like that word. There's some words that really sound good, don't they? Vexing, that's a good word. What's the other one I like? Oh, nuts, can't think of it at the moment. It's got, I like what is it? English teacher?
Onomatopoeia.
Yeah, onomatopoeia. I like that, even if I can't say it. But anyway, God's vexed with a country called Egypt. Because in Egypt, they had worked out a way to live together that was just exactly the opposite of what God's dream was about and what God wanted to mend the world about. And it looked like, see if we can get a good one. I'm sneaky, I have one in my pocket. It looked like this. Up at the top was Pharaoh. Next to the top was Pharaoh's family. Next were all the people working for Pharaoh. Government workers, huh? The next time was the big deals, whoever they were. The next was the common people, you know, the ones that did the ordinary thing. And down to the bottom were the slaves. Pharaoh's way of working. Everybody pushed at the people below him. And by pushing at the people below him, getting stuff from them, they were able to stay on top. And so these people could have lots, and these people could have nothing. And up above it was some kind of a god blessing the Pharaoh and helping from the sides. Is the military, because you got to keep these people in line. You don't want them moving up. And religion. And God said, I want to take my people away from that. I want to free them from that. And so this then becomes a theme in Dan's book of the Pharaoh way of living as being the opposite of the way of God's living. We'll say more now to illustrate what God's living is as well. And so God sends a youngster called Moses and his older sister Miriam. I think it's good for us to remember that Miriam was his oldest, his older sister. And Aaron out to let his people go. And by pushing and pushing, finally Pharaoh says, out, get rid of you people. And they escape. And then he has the story about the exodus, the getting out of the land of Egypt. And then Dan makes a really big point. The whole Hebrew scriptures must be viewed from this story. This is the lens by which you begin to understand what the Hebrew scriptures are about. And it starts with this God wanting to get rid of this style of living, not just get them out of that so they aren't bricklayers anymore, so they can be something else, but away from this kind of thinking and be able to set up a place where the experiment on the speck might be tried again. And so he frees them, and they're dancing for joy on the other side of the river. But then God says, but you got to go to school. Oh, and by the way, in many of these places, way down in the corner, Dan has two little chipmunks or mice or something like that. And they're often making comments as they come up out of the hole, looking at what's going on. And in the wilderness, God sends them into the wilderness, to the wilderness school, to learn about how to live not like that. And the one mouse says, they have to be taught how to live. The other one says, they're only human. And so in the wilderness school, there's a classroom set up, and Dan's thinking here, and the teacher is saying, today's lesson, living as free people. And then somebody on the side said, are we graded, or is it pass-fail? You know? And so that's why they have to learn how to live. But how does God teach out in the wilderness? Well, as Dan puts it, God waits for the teachable moment. The people complain about the food. We don't like this stuff. We had better stuff down in Egypt. And so God sends them manna. The word just means, what is it? The people came out and said, what is it? You know, there was some edible substance that was just great. And he gave them three lessons with the manna. Here's Dan's interpretation of the lessons. God provided manna each day. The lesson was, all food is God's, comes from God. Lesson, you didn't make it, you didn't get it, you didn't till it, it's God's. Remember that. Second, the people gathered each day manna in their own clan, so that work is a dignified activity of gathering up. It's okay to work to get the manna that God provides. Thirdly, larger clans gathered more manna, smaller clans gathered less manna, and everybody had enough. God gives daily food, so hoarding is unnecessary. Food is for all, not just what the big deals or the deserving get. God gives enough, sufficient. That's lesson one. Lesson two, some of the people tried to hoard it. You remember what happened? It rotted. And so the second lesson is, hoarding stinks. So some people hoarded God's manna. The manna they kept grew maggots and smelled foul. And the Pharaoh's Egypt way of accumulating stuff and stacking it up brings rot, decay, and death. Lesson two. Lesson three, wilderness, right? Learning how to live, humans, non-Pharaoh way, is the gift of Sabbath. No manna fell on the seventh day of the week. Enough manna fell on the sixth day of the week, and the people to feed the people on both the sixth and the seventh day, and the manna stored for the Sabbath didn't rot. The lesson being, humans do not have to work every day. Now, I hate to be this heretical with Americans, you know, this is pretty much heresy. Humans do not have to work every day to receive and distribute God's manna. The extra time is a beautiful gift of God which makes it possible for humans and animals, by the way, and the earth to rest. Sabbath allows humans to experience full time the wonder of friendship with God, with others, and with all creation. And so he has people resting. And the two people down there says, "What's happening?" And the other one says, "Nothing." On the Sabbath rest. So the story that he is, we own nothing, all is God's gift. God's gifts are enough for all to be shared. Hoarding causes rot, it stinks. Work is helping God distribute his manna, her manna. The gift of God promises to all. God gives rest so human can practice full time what life is all about: friendship with God, friendship with others, friendship with nature. The context for the life, as he calls it, the manna style of living. They become manna people and they live manna style, depending on what God gives rather than setting up a system like that. And I like this part where Dan says, God poured out manna day after day, dreaming of a universal manna society. Here's how Dan thinks God thought that would work. Oh, let me find where he says that. Maybe passed it by him. Oh, yeah, here it is. Yahweh thought of a wonderful plan. I will tenderly raise this child people and teach them how to live as mature partners with me. The nations of the world will notice how these people live. They will see how joyful life can be. Tired of war, oppression, and greed, they will ask these people to teach them how to live. Through these people, I will teach all nations to live as partners with me, and then the day of shalom will come to all humans and to the whole creation. Let me watch my time. I'll take 5 more minutes and then ask you to respond to it, okay? So, the next part of the wilderness meeting is God establishes a covenant with them. And they have a big deal. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember. I didn't. What a big celebration that was when the law was given. All kinds of dancing and everything else. And we've been given this story, you know, God comes down and bashes them with these commandments. Rather, it was a gift of a covenant. I'm going to make a deal. I will bind myself to this people, God says. That's pretty big stuff. again, the stuff to get excited about. To be able to talk about a God that binds God to the people and to the creation. And they celebrate it like mad. And then God says, and I'll give you a letter. I'll write it down for you in a couple of tablets of how you can work this out. And then he has two tablets, and at the bottom of the one he says, continued on next tablet. And says, dear partners, God says, I chose you and liberated you. Therefore, you will trust me only. You will bring honor to my name. Remember? You will keep the Sabbath holy. And when you are tempted to follow the way of Egypt, or the way of the people around you, you will refuse. You will honor your parents. You will not kill. You will not run after somebody else's spouse. You will not steal or deceive. And you will not covet your neighbor's manna. Love God. And that's the exciting covenant that God makes with these people. And Moses and the people give thanks and already begin their Sabbath living. God added to that Sabbath, you may remember, that on the Sabbath day, the seventh day of the week, people rested. And then there was a Sabbath year, the seventh year, and then the Jubilee year, the 50th year. On the Sabbath day, the partner people rest, gift of grace. On the Sabbath years, many joyful things happen. The people and the land rest. Work animals enjoy rest. There's a picture of an oxen saying, this is a good year. You know, there will be abundant food for all. All debts will be canceled. One way to keep Pharaoh's Egypt from happening. And all slaves go free. Every seventh year. How they get there, we have to talk about that sometime, but they get slaves too. And then Jubilees, all land lost because of debt or misfortune, go back to the original inheritor. In this way, God assures that this society will never become like Pharaoh's Egypt, with rich and poor, land hoarders and landless slave workers. By keeping the Jubilee, God's people will live as God's contrast society. And then God gives them also the gift of worship, enables them to respond to this God that starts a manna society and dreams of a manna world. We don't talk much about dreams. I think I pointed out before in the new Lutheran Book of Worship, for those of you who are Lutheran, I think I'm right in saying there's only once that the word dream comes in. The scriptures are filled with dreams, you know. People are having dreams all the time, the meaning of dreams. But we Lutherans, we sneak in one dream. You know, gather the hopes and the dreams of all. But we rarely talk about the dreams of God. And God dreams. God talks about his wanting for people as his dream, you know. His dream home, his dream world, his dream cosmos, and works it out. And just in case you, I'll stop now, just in case you're waiting, as he gets into the New Testament scriptures, then he said, you know, in the Old Testament, when he had to look through lenses to see everything through the Exodus, the being freed, in the New Testament, the lenses are what happened with Jesus Christ in his suffering, his death and resurrection. And then you will again be able to see the dreams of God. Okay? Well, that's a little bit about Dan Erlander, the first few chapters. You got some responses, some questions, some suggestions, some whatever? You're welcome to have whatever. Dan does good stuff, that's for sure, I think. Well, do you like it or not, or what?
I love it. Yes. Love a lot of possibilities. Okay.
So now do you all promise to go out and buy the book? Not so.
There are two ways it fits the African scene very well. One is that they use stories more than we.
Sure.
Because it's kind of hard to talk about other things, or things of the beginning and that without stories. And oral tradition is a passing down of stories. And the other way that it's, it sounds very, very good for the African is that the tremendous emphasis they have on dreams is one way that you know and experience and are guided.
Okay. Good. Dan's been to Africa. He came back about 3 weeks ago from South Africa. I should give credit to his wife, who puts up with all this stuff. Karen, graduate of Luther College, played in the Luther College marching band. I always like to give her credit. There's always some Luther College people around, so that's okay. Anybody else? See, I don't mind ending classes early. You know, a lot of people here go on and on. I don't care. But I'll be glad to talk with you. Yeah?
I was here when Dan was here.
Right.
And he, this is the whatever.
Right. He did a manna people thing first before he did this book. Yes.
He did a slideshow of the village, of ugly things in the village.
Yes.
That we would think were ugly, but to him they were beautiful.
Right. Right.
A beautiful sign.
Yeah, he's a marvelous photographer. He's an artist. There's no question about it. I mean, marvelous photographer as well. Right. And we used to, I don't know if they still show the slides about holding around.
I asked about it.
Oh, yeah. Dan did the four seasons of Holden, and you could go through watching that. So some of you have seen that. Someone else?
Well, he is a biblical theologian, too, because it is the Exodus that holds the whole thing together. The Psalms and prophets are just full of this gift of the covenant.
Right. Yeah, many references to the Psalms in this book. Yeah. The biblical references are often the Psalms. Someone else. How do you feel about Egypt?
Right on.
Remind you of any other place?
It's frighteningly familiar.
Pardon?
It's frighteningly familiar.
Does the attempt to reconcile evolution or the theory of the Big Bang and all that, or is that just, we don't know exactly what the time frame is? This isn't the place or time, but I always get curious.
Oh, no, he doesn't deal with that here.
That's always.
Yeah.
As my husband was a scientist.
I think his point is, it's always time. I mean, like right now. Right now is always the most important time. In other words, whatever's going to happen could happen right now. Whether it's going to be the shalom world, God's dream come true, or the end of it all, or whatever else, it's always coming right now. I think that's fair to Dan. And if Dan doesn't like it, he can come up. He's going to be up here in March. He can undo all this if he wants to. Yes?
Didn't Dan start the first resource center here at Holden?
Yes, he did. Right. He was pastor here in the village with John Schramm. And then I think it was he and maybe John. I want to give both of them credit. They both had the idea that this place could be a resource center to people out after they leave the place or even if they've never been here. And Dan would put out things like this in little pages and mail them out all over the place and had an absolutely horrendously complicated way of keeping things together, and you had to watch three different things to be able to put it in the right spot in your book and he would write about it. If you didn't put them in your book when you got them in a three ring folder, then you didn't have a happy resource packet. And if you did have them in the right place, then you had a happy resource packet. You can see he enjoys life, yeah.
The question is, did he spend a fair amount of time in Egypt, in Israel, in the Holy Land?
No.
Nothing sort of
No, he's done most of his work, his studies, in the books that you'll see reflected here. Marcus Bohr, who's going to be, was here this summer, is going to be here again, is a big influence on him. He wrote, should know that book title. No, I guess it's in back. I don't think I put my hands on it. Marcus Bohr is one of them. Politics of Jesus by
Yoder
is another.
Don Douglas Hall,
whom I had the fortune of catching on the phone up in Montreal this summer and chatted with him. He's a very strong influence on Dan too. So some of those right, and then his own plowing around. He reads a lot, and as I said, he's one of those gifted people who remembers and absorbs what he reads.
What's his position now? What's he doing?
Oh, and he was originally a parish pastor, started in St. Charles, Illinois, then was in San Diego, and then he was assistant pastor in Albuquerque, and then he came up here. That's what I was leading into. He was pastor here, and then they started the resource center, and he was there for at least a year or two, and then I was called to come, and my first act was to ask Dan and Karen to stay a year, and they did. And then he was called with Susan Breel and Martin Wells, and the three of them are the campus pastors at Pacific Lutheran. The three of them have two positions. So they don't work full time. Dan works Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Sunday, and he has Thursday, Friday off, and Saturday to monkey around. But he's a perfectionist. You know, that's why it took so long with the book. If there's a period, the period might be over a quarter, 16th of an inch, and it belongs over here, and Dan will redo the page and put the period over. Yes.
A pyramid.
Yeah.
It's awful familiar. We haven't been able to wipe that out.
Right. And that's why God still has a dream, I think what Dan would say. You know, it hasn't happened, but it is a dream, and it is God's dream, and that we are partners with God to try and keep moving that way by trying to be manna people in the way we live with one another, and getting the strength from that, from the God who, shall we say, bets on his people, her people, and by hooking into that Son of God, Jesus the Christ, who came and hanging on for dear life. Because it ain't going to go away by itself in any way. It's going to have to be God's way. Yep.
We had a Bible study this morning where he compared death-dealing and
life-giving.
Giving, and it fits very well with with the pyramid.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Sure he does. Someone else?
In the coining of phrases,
this
great experiment, that's negative to my thing. We coin phrases to make interesting and so on, but somehow or other, the great experiment, just for me, it doesn't fit the concept of God. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any better phrase, but I just have negative hearing feelings when we think of God as the great experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he took a chance in his creation on that.
Right.
I wouldn't know what other word to say, but I don't like the word experiment.
Yeah.
It makes it too earthly, too human for
the concept. Oh, so God wouldn't be an experiment for you. Does God change her mind? Hebrew scriptures say so. So that's the kind of God, it seems to me, we have to deal with. No, but I'm not saying we have to use the word experiment, well, whatever way. But we can't dodge whatever might be behind. I think what Dan is trying to get at is the fact that we want a God who's, you know, guaranteed. And, you know, there's a biblical passage, New Testament, where God, you know, fear not, for your heavenly Father will give you the kingdom. That's not exact translation. The better translation is, I think, for your heavenly Father has determined to give you the kingdom. I like a determined God, you know. But then I have to deal with the old Hebrew scriptures where God does say that it's possible for God to change. And, you know, and he considered, I believe he considered doing away with the whole gang. I think he considered opening up the heavens and scaring the daylights.
He does.
Sure.
Several occasions in Sodom, you know, there's 10 people or 20 people or 15 or 10, which still destroyed. Sure.
So I think that's what he's trying to get at. And, but let, you know, as you say, let's find the words that are helpful. They may not all make us feel good either, but they might be helpful. But I appreciate your saying that.
I agree with his criticism, though.
Yeah.
It seems to anchor the underlying metaphor to the scientific method and rationality, and implies really a lack of vision to just experiment with something. In the creation, I would expect a true vision that follows through.
I'd say perhaps, and I'm not scientific, but I am theological, and what you just said would bother me theologically. Bother me theology, it doesn't mean it's right or wrong, you know.
Maybe the sustainable word is that God is a God who takes risks. I don't know how you feel about your life. If I look back at mine, anything I've ever done or had that's worthwhile had a great element of risk in it and scared the daylights out of me. Certainly God is portrayed, I think, in the scripture, in story form and otherwise, as a God who...
His love is so complete, he's willing to take that risk.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of God, I thank you for that. Comes closer, it seems to me, that in absolute and complete love, you're willing to take a risk.
And what does the word risk mean, then, in that context? The complete love, I don't have any question about it, but I do question the meaning of that word risk. Could it fail? If it could fail, then it's an experiment, I think. Could it fail? I've not asked you to answer it, but see, that would be my question. And I wouldn't walk away any more from the word risk than I would from the word absolute love. I'd want both of them. You see, here and now I'll get in trouble, and this is not Dan or right. I think the key word in all of theology is ambiguity. I really do. Faith is ambiguity all the way along. If it isn't possible for you not to believe, the question is, do you believe? Always on the edge. Always on the edge. For me, you know, not God. No, the problem isn't with God. We're talking about words about God. We're not trying to look, we're trying to look in the mind of God as best we can from what we have. But us, as we form words about God, like experiment or risk or great love or story or whatever we do. That's why we're saints and sinners of the wrong kind. How do you put that ambiguity together? It's really tough. For me, boy, I wouldn't want to run from it. Okay, so my point was, as long as we're not running from any part of God, let's find every words we can. And we'll probably be running all the time. You know, it would have to be corrected, each one of us. I think I will. Anybody else? More on this, too. Whatever.
Well, could you say something about the theological foundations of the root metaphors to the notion of experiment as I might fail in giving my whole self to another person.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand all the questions. You're using terminology outside of my experience.
Oh.
But go ahead. But, you know, come at it.
I'm just struggling with the word experiment.
Yeah. And experiment.
My first understanding of it was through the scientific metaphor of 20th century rational science.
Okay. I think others in this room might ask you, what does that mean?
What does?
the two last phrases you used.
That you kind of tinker with things and you manipulate
measurable
variables and you develop hypotheses and test them and you're objectively removed and detached from the process.
Is that what you hear in the word experiment? Some of you do.
The basis of technology.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that would not be what I was using for, nor the way I understand it. Okay. Yeah.
So you said experiment, if it has the possibility of failing, if you can't believe in God, if there isn't the possibility of not believing, like Kierkegaard
That would be my, and again, therefore, anybody who has using the word experiment that way, I wouldn't use the word, I'd say let's back away from it. But I'd still use something like it to get at the point that it might.
I like your explanation that you're using. I was just wondering what some of the theological foundation of that might be.
Oh. Quotes from God where God gets disappointed with it all.
Would you say Martin Luther was experimenting when he broke from the Catholic Church? Stood over against all of the world as Catholic and leapt toward his own faith in something different.
I don't know.
A new cause.
As I look back now, I'd say yeah. I don't think he was that sure. You know, we paint these people over so many. You know, everything was black. Excuse me, not black and white. What do we say? Right or wrong or whatever it may be. I don't believe that. And that there might have been some experiment in it, and that there might have been some selfishness in it, and there might have been some jealousy in it, and there might have been personality conflicts with his bishops in it. I'd add all of that into it and say, yeah, it was a big kind of a thing, but it worked, and I'm glad. But that was, I wouldn't use the experiment in that context, but if I pushed on it enough, I suppose I could be led to do that. If it means it wouldn't work. He was sure some things were right or wrong. But he also, and he was wrong about something. Dead wrong. My gosh, he was wrong. Now, how do you decide which ones are right or wrong? How does he decide? How do we, as we look back? Yaroslav Pelikan said, my gosh, if we don't lay out Luther the way he really was, we're doing a great disservice to the church. And I don't think he had any more insight into what is absolute or what will work, than you and I do. And therefore, I probably could say spare. But all I would mean is that, we're dealing with God's dream. And that's big stuff for non-gods to dream or deal with. Somebody else? Yeah.
I like the word experiment, because that's what I see in nature, the difference with how the animals were created, and how specialized some of them were.
Okay.
Some of those that we know that are extinct. Mm-hmm. I think, my father-in-law was an inventor, and he had such a good time with it. I picked up from him the approaches they're not dead end, and then you do a little map. That's how I picture it. He must have had so much fun doing it.
I like that image. And by the way, I want to say I learned in this exchange, I'll use that word differently, because I've been taught that there's different ways of looking at that.
The word I really like from Dan is dream.
Yeah.
because there you're moving away from truth is verifiable fact or something like that, and you're
all
in
right.
an area which it seems to be invites risk and all sorts of things that are fluid rather than static.
Okay. Thank you. Well, our time
is a vision and gives a plan.
Yep. And God calls it a dream, also. Just, I mean, again, I wouldn't want to run away from what God calls it. But I'd use vision, I'd use plan, and I would use dream. Well, thank you. Tomorrow night, if you have time.